mistake of enlightenment.
The mistake of enlightenment.
I call that a mistake. You say a mistake.
But the book is a mistake, as you call it.
Yes, mistake. And that has been translated into a lot of languages, French, Italian, German, Polish, Russian,
Chinese. Can I have this
copy? We don't have the first book. No. These are the French translations of the first two books.
Oh. Well, I had a couple of years of high school French. You
struggled through it.
What?
As I had a couple of years of high school French, but
oh,
I don't think I could get through it. Well, I have written quite a bit. I've talked to quite a few spiritual teachers. I guess people call themselves spiritual teachers or gurus. I actually interviewed Krishnamurti a few years before he died.
I see.
He was here. In some ways, what you seem to be saying, at least all I really know is what I read in these few articles that Paul sent me. Some newspaper clippings.
Yeah.
So that's about all I know about you, and a few things he said. But what you're saying seems to be a bit like what J. Krishnamurti was
saying. Basically, there is a fundamental difference between the two Krishnamurtis, if I may put it that way, and because they all assume that there is such a thing as mind. See, I question the mind, I question the consciousness, and I make, if I may use that word, assertive statements that there are no thoughts there. You see, the thoughts are not self-generated and spontaneous. You see, thoughts are responsive to the stimuli. I stress the whole thing, you see, in pure and simple physical and physiological terms. So I explain why I emphasize that if there is any such thing as enlightenment, it should be expressed in physiological terms, not in mystical or religious terms. It's why they did before is not my interest at all. I don't know.
I mean, enlightenment is just sort of a physical function of the brain, something
when
that
one
chemically happens.
Chemically happens. And I have no doubt that if you take, for example, what we call desire. Desire is an expression of life, you see. So as a matter of fact, what they say is correct. It is a hormone, you see. Once you accept the fact that it is a hormone, all that we have built around that and the demand that we should free ourselves from desires, replace desires with spiritual desires, and try to be in a desireless state, all that has no meaning to me. So the whole thing is built on the foundation of the value system, you see. And the value systems, whether it is oriental or occidental, have evolved around the lives of the spiritual teachers like Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad. And this is what I'm emphasizing. Unfortunately, we have placed before ourselves the ideal of a perfect being, you know. And naturally, the only way you can become a perfect being is to try to fit into the value system. I don't know if I make myself. I maintain that the value system is false, and any attempt on the part of all individuals to fit themselves into the value system is the cause of man's
any value system.
It's not that I'm against
nihilism. Is that nihilism?
It is not nihilism, you see. That's an easy way on the part of some people, you see, to put a label.
There's anything wrong with it. I mean, what's the difference between it?
Nihilism is negating everything for the sake of negating. But you see, the nihilism also, the goal of nihilism is to reach the same goal through a negative approach. You know, to me, the negative approach has been evolved by people who have failed to reach their goals, no matter what the nature of the goal is, through positive means. So the goal is a positive goal. So no matter what you call it, whether it is a negative approach or a positive approach, it really doesn't matter. I'm questioning the goal, you see, that we have placed before ourselves. But the nature seems to be interested in a totally a different thing. It is perfecting the human species, you know. This is what I'm emphasizing all the time. Yesterday I gave an interview to this Michael Thoms. You know, he has a program here, New Dimensions.
Yeah.
New Dimensions. I emphasized the same things yesterday.
So, you still talking about perfecting the human species,
yes,
but that's not your goal.
No, it's if nature is, that is an assumption of our part, we have no way of finding out this, whether what nature is interested in, whether nature is really has a plan, is it is perfecting the species, is anybody's guess. But what is wrong with the culture or the society in which we are functioning is that it has placed before us, you see, the goal of a perfect being, you know. To evolve yourself or to become a perfect being, you have to fit into yourself into the value systems. See, that is where the civilization has taken a wrong turn. And because it asserts that every individual should fit himself or herself into the framework. And whereas, you see, every human being is a unique being, and it is the superimposition of that, or the input of a cultural value system on the evolving human beings, is the one that has thwarted the, I don't know what word you say, has prevented the possibility of what is there, you see, to blossom into a unique individual.
That sounds a bit like what Jay Krishnamurti was saying, that any philosophy you put, if you're trying to live any ideology or philosophy, it just gets in the way, it just clutters things up.
He says that there is something that you can do to change that into
meditation.
Meditation, or you see, the awareness, choiceless awareness, and I maintain that the awareness is an integral part of the activity of the brain, and it cannot be separated from the activity and used as an instrument to bring about any change there. That is one thing, and I don't see that there is anything there to be changed, you see, that there is anything there to be radically changed, you see. So to talk of a radical change, of something that does not exist, there has no meaning to me. So to talk of a mutation of mind is absurd, because, you see, there is no such thing as a mind there at all. You see, the mind is the totality of the experiences, you see, thoughts, feelings, and experiences. And there are no individuals, according to me. You see, the society or culture, whatever you want to call it, has created these individuals for its own continuity and its status quo. So, and at the same time, it emphasizes that we should all become individuals. And so that has created the neurotic situation in the individuals. So when we push ourselves to fit into that framework, you see, or that value system, or whatever you want to call it, it pushes us in the direction of breaking down. You see, we all have become not only neurotic individuals, but it has become necessary for us to stay that way. The neurosis is an essential and integral part of our lives to survive in this society that we find ourselves in.
So what's the way out of this neurosis?
And the more you try to fit yourself into, the greater is the danger, you see, of moving into the other direction and become manic depressive individuals. Or live in the hope that one day, through more and more effort, and you will be able to fit yourself into that framework. That to me is something which cannot be achieved, except that we can live in hope and die in hope. And living with this, or trying to accept that also has no meaning at all. You see, you are constantly in conflict with the society, with the culture, or whatever you want to call it.
So what do we do?
If I suggest some other way, you add a...
What do you do?
To the techniques...
What do you do? I mean, how do you deal with the world?
The world is lost, according to me. See, there is nothing that you can do to reverse the course of events. Progressively, we are moving in the direction of destroying ourselves. But we can delay the destructive forces through the realization that if we try to destroy your neighbors, you will also go with them. See, that is the way the human body is functioning. That's the way the cellular structure is functioning. But if you place before ourselves the idea of love thy neighbor as thyself, you see, our brotherhood, or all these ideals before us, we only push these things and then back them up with violence. You see, the whole foundation of culture or civilization or whatever you want to call is built on the foundation to kill and to be killed. If you look at the history of mankind, more people have been killed in the name of love thy neighbor as thyself than all these recent wars put together. You see, all religions, there is not one single exception, you see. Unfortunately, the three great religions we have, Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity, have been used as instruments of power. Otherwise, they would all have remained cults like any other cults we have in our midst today. So when once you use them as instrument of power, backed by destructive instruments of destruction, there's not much hope there for us.
But if you just were able to somehow magically abolish all religions, you're saying you would still have wars and violence, wouldn't you, over
but all
economics
the,
or even, land or whatever?
Even the political ideologies which we have evolved are nothing but the watery outgrowths of the religious thinking of man. See, the problem is that somewhere along the evolutionary process, I'm not even sure there is such a thing as an evolution, the humans felt this self-consciousness the first time. That is to say, they separated from themselves from the totality of the whole nature. And then that is responsible for the fear, see, because he's lost, he's all alone.
So it's this break from nature,
from
it's
the
this
nature,
the separation
yes.
from natural
the whole
process, whatever that is. And you don't claim to know what that is.
No, I don't know, nobody knows.
Yeah,
see,
yeah.
See? Uh-huh. So this the whole thing is one single unit. See, when once this separation born out of self-consciousness occurred, he has evolved all this, you see, the religious thing.
So is there some way to get back to that, recapture this lost state, this Garden of Eden or whatever?
I don't see there is any way. The more
But you seem to say there was a Garden of Eden, in a sense, and not literally, but I mean, there was a time, you seem to be saying, there was a time when there was not this separation.
Yeah, but when and why this separation occurred, you see, and if you try to find out the cause of it all, there would only be a hazarding opinions on that. We have no way of finding out why this occurred. I can hazard an opinion that nature may... You see, whatever is born is destroyed. You see, whatever is created has to be destroyed. So actually the creation and destruction is a simultaneous process. You see, everything that is born has to go. And we are only delaying that process through the help of thinking which we have developed, you see. So it is no doubt helped us, you see, to survive longer than the others.
But the complete destruction is inevitable?
It is inevitable, that's what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
And
is there a reason to delay? I mean, mm-hmm. Is there a reason for us to... So we're delaying the inevitable. We are delaying the inevitable.
We are delaying.
So what's wrong with that?
No, I mean, nothing wrong. I'm not saying it is wrong, but the idea that one day, see, we are going to create a paradise or heaven on this planet is a far-fetched idea. And I maintain the very idea of creating heaven on this planet is the one that is turning this which nature has created, say, you know, into hell. So is there anything, that's the question that everybody throws at you, you see, the question that is there anything that we can do to change, you see, or reverse the process. Reverse it is, for what, you see. To me, you see, the human species, you may not agree, others may not agree, is a sort of virus on this planet.
Is what?
Virus, you see.
A virus.
You see. So the, it's just like cancer or any other thing, you know. And through this, the techniques we have evolved, the value system, we are only delaying the process, you see, of destruction, but not actually doing anything to stop this, you know.
Can we do anything to stop it?
You can do anything, but there is no way you can stop it.
So there's nothing else to do, right? There's really nothing else you can do but what we're doing now.
What are we doing? That's what I'm saying.
But see, what else can
anything
we do?
Anything that has, you know, what I'm saying is the thought in its very nature is a protective mechanism. And anything that is born out of it, see, whether it is a religious teaching or a political ideology or economic systems is to distribute the wealth, which of course is not going to happen anyway, because nobody is going to part with anything. Is a protective mechanism. So anything that is born out of that is destructive. So in our demand to understand the nature's laws, you see, unfortunately we are using them not for the benefit of the whole of mankind, for destructive purposes. The so-called progress we are so proud of is really not a progress, because the all that we have discovered, the laws of nature, you see, are used for destructive purposes. Why we have created...
You mean all environmental...
The environmental problems...
How is that being used for destruction? How is this awareness...
You see, because we have assumed that the humans are created for some special grander purpose.
Other than
all the other species on this planet. So... in our demand to use everything for ourselves, we are creating this the ecological problems, polluting everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all that I'm saying. So, to talk of ecological, what is it there? To take care of that is all our energies are wasted. You see, to create an instrument or, you see, an organization or to do something to put an end to or delay this process is only adding to that momentum.
When you said these energies are wasted, you imply there's something else to do with these energies.
Not something else to do, but you see, it is not something that a small group of people can do it. See, it is beyond the scope of individuals. You see, individually there isn't much that we can do about it. But collectively means it's war. You see, I have a way of solving the problems, you have a way of solving the problems. And so we both end up in the battlefield, you see. Take, for example, the problem of starvation. And we have our own political ideology, the others have their own political ideology. If you accept this political system to solve the problem of starvation, we will succeed in... eliminating the problem of starvation. They also say exactly the same thing. So both these systems are backed by powerful instruments of destruction, backed by them. See, so what happens? They both end up in the battlefield to solve this problem of starvation, but this starvation is still there. And if all this progress, the scientific advances, the technological miracles we have achieved, they have not percolated to the level of the common man. See, it helps only a negligible percentage of the people on this planet. And are we doing the right thing? You know, not that I'm suggesting that we should all go back to the age of the bullock cart. I grew up in a place where the only mode of transportation available to me until I was 21 years was the bullock cart. So people ask me that why you are using bullock cart.
Oh, bullock cart, yeah.
Yes, you see. And people ask me why you are using all these cars, planes, because that is the mode of transportation that is available to me. And there is no special charm in trying to reverse the whole thing or to turn the clock back and go back to to the age of the bull of court. I don't see any charm in that kind of a thing.
You were born in India. Where in India?
South India. I was born in South India, Madras, very near Madras.
Now, and you had some sort of formal religious training?
You will find that, you see, the story of my life in that book instead of repeating that.
Uh-huh. In which book?
In the introduction of that book.
You were working with the Theosophy Society? When were you doing that?
But I was the secretary, international lecturer.
What years?
That was in 1947 to 53. Mm-hmm. That was the time when I had personal encounters with the J. Krishnamurti also. He was part of my background. Mm-hmm. You see, I was born into a Theosophical family. Mm-hmm. And my contacts with the leaders of the Theosophical Society pushed me into that field. So there came a time when I felt that
it's still going. Yeah, a few minutes.
It was recording before?
No. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Just wanted to see you here. Now it's got some more time. Just tell me a little bit of, you were a leader in the Theosophy Society.
Rising leader. I did not reach the top of the Theosophical Society.
Was Annie Besant still around then?
Yes, I was an young boy at that time. She died when I was 14 or 15, but I was closely connected with the second generation or third generation of the leaders of the Theosophical Society. Mm-hmm. But
Krishnamurti had already kind of separated himself.
He separated long time before my time. You see, but he used to come there and talk, and I listened to him during that period between 1947 and 53. Mm-hmm. So I met him several times, but we didn't get along well. And there came a time when I parted company with him.
What was the problem?
The problem was the basic problem, and his emphasis that there is a mind and there is such a thing as a transformation of, radical transformation or mutation of mind. And basically, although I studied psychology, my master's degree, I always questioned, you see, the very foundation of the psychological thinking. That there is something there to be transformed radically, you know. That there is a self, that there is some center there, that there is a psyche, that there is a soul and all that kind of a thing. Never really interested me at all, you see, because I didn't find anything at all. Not, you see, once you come to a point and maintain that God is irrelevant, it does not mean that you are an atheist or even an agnostic, you see, you know. And we leave God, the existence of God and the cosmological, teleological, ontological proofs of the existence of God to the theologians. But the dependence on some power outside of you destroys the possibility of discovering things for yourself and by yourself. That was my approach to the problem, you see. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
And you had some personal experience?
There in that detail.
But just briefly, would you describe it? You could describe it.
No, it's difficult. You know, they are enumerated there. If you have a chance, you can read them. It's not that I'm trying to avoid. To go into that is difficult. But what I want to emphasize is that whatever I have discovered, stumbled into, has no religious content in it at all. It has no mystical undertones, overtones, or any tones for that matter. And to express that, you see, in religious and mystical terms is to falsify. This is what I have found. I have been lucky, you see, to find myself. Something hit me, you see. Lately I have been describing that whatever happened to me, you see.
This is a thing I read in 67.
Yes, it's similar to the earthquake, you see here. You see, when it hits you, or you call it lightning, when it hits you, the whole living organism, this human body, frees itself from the stranglehold, you see, of thought, feelings and experiences of everybody that felt experience before you. The whole thing is flushed out of your system, and the body begins to function in quite a different way. And all those inactive, ductless glands that are there in the body are suddenly activated, and there is a sort of a new equilibrium, you see. I don't know.
But this is what some people would call enlightenment. Explaining this in a different way, but isn't that what a lot of people in the past have called enlightenment? That sort of a.
I don't see any. See, it's a rubbed coin, and so everybody is selling enlightenment. You see, the marketplace. It has become a shoddy piece of spiritual goodies. You see, because there seems to be a market for that, and people are selling that.
Why is there such a market for that? What is it that's so attractive to people?
It is simple, because then once you feel that you have everything. And all your needs are taken care of, naturally the question arises, is that all? So then you create a market for this kind of a thing, you see. Mm-hmm. So when once you are for some reason dissatisfied with your own religion, with your own church, with your own religious thinking, you look here, there and everywhere. And so there is, and here particularly in this country, you want something new every time. See, and those who come from outside have all kinds of different techniques, and one of the reasons why, you see, the market became very attractive and lucrative for all these gurus from the East is the drugs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when
psychedelic drugs.
And psychedelic drugs, you see, have given some sort of an experience to the people, especially of that generation. And that created the need to demand varieties of religious experiences, you see. And so, in those countries, they have every kind of gimmick, every kind of system there. So, one after the other.
What do you think that psychedelic experience was that people had?
It is basically nothing. It's a chemical disturbance in the system of the body. I maintain that all the techniques of yoga, meditation, gives you a sort of high, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like a drug.
Like a drug, you see. Yeah. This is a slower process, whereas the drugs act upon the chemistry of your body and produces these experiences, which basically are no different from all the other religious experiences. You know, when once you have an experience which is of an extraordinary nature, you want to share it with everyone, you see. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are caught up, you see, in trying to have more and more experiences and varieties of experiences. But basically,